Hello and welcome to another episode of Defense Uncut, the first English language Pakistani defense news commentary podcast where we unpack Pakistani military procurements, events, and issues in laser-focused detail so that you build an accurate and informative big picture. In this episode, Aseem and I will take a look into the future of Pakistan's aerospace industry. Now, this isn't a new question, certainly not for the Pakistan Air Force or PAF. In fact, in 2017, the PAF had initiated its very own next-gen fighter program under Project ASIM. However, that program would basically fall through and in turn be succeeded by Project PFX. We'll take a look at both programs and unpack why Project ASIM failed and, by consequence, how PFX was adapted to be more realistic. However, we'll also highlight the big structural constraints preventing the Pakistani aerospace industry from advancing both its ability to develop new platforms, but also manufacture them at a scale that would greatly benefit the Pakistani economy and Pakistani warplanners. Unfortunately, we don't have Arslan with us this week as he's still managing a personal matter, but he will be back with us soon enough. So Aseem, how are you?
Good. Great to be here.
Great. So let's go on to the first topic of our discussion, the future of the JF-17 program. So as you know, the Pakistan Air Force has largely inducted the number of JF-17s it had intended to procure when it first started the program. In fact, the original plan had called for around 150 units, and it has more than exceeded that, especially through the induction of the JF-17B twin-seater, which was not originally planned for. So that being said, we decided it would be a good idea to look back at the JF-17 program and see whether it has any additional legs as far as the PAF is concerned. Would the PAF look for another variant? Would the PAF look to replace its Block 1s with a new built JF-17 variant, especially as the Block 1s are reaching the end of their life cycle? But anyways, Aseem, let's get into it. What is the future of the JF-17 program? Do you think that the PAF will continue procuring new units, or do you foresee the PAF moving on or pivoting on to a different fighter?
Okay, so it's hard to say for sure what PAF's plan is, but based on what we're seeing right now, I have some opinions on what is going on. So on one hand, it seems like the PAF is focusing more on things like the J-10, because as you've said many times before on this podcast, PAF doesn't like to induct like just 20 of an aircraft, right? So there's going to be a significant number of J-10s inducted into the PAF. And furthermore, as we've discussed, J-10 has, a little bit of more capacity compared to JF-17. So it's a slightly bigger aircraft. It has more payload, more range, all that stuff. So it certainly feels like the J-10 is what PAF is focusing on. Secondly, when it comes to the JF-17, which was started, a couple of decades ago, its first blocks, right? So the Block 1 JF-17s, the first of which came online back as 2003, they're basically nearing the end of or at the end of their structural life. And again, this is just my opinion, but I don't believe that JF-17 structure was built with a structural life extension program that we have for the F-16, something like that in mind for the JF-17. And it certainly feels like doing that on the JF-17 would be more expensive than just building a brand new structural, like Block 3 or something like that. So I don't feel like the Block 1s are going to be, put through like a significant MLU program. Block 2s, certainly. And what I suspect is going to happen is, and we're going to talk about this later as well, perhaps through the PFX program, you'll probably be producing more Block 3s and maintaining the number of JF-17s at like 150 or something like that, 150, 180 or something like that. And we'll keep, building new ones. And maybe at some point, the Block 3s are going to go through an MLU because probably the structural, science has Block 3 has a more advanced structure you know, in terms of materials that can, that has more capacity to be put through an MLU, for example. So in my mind, the future PAF is sort of based on 150 JF-17s, 100 to 150 J-10s, and maybe 40 or 50 cons, and lots of UCAVs, which we are definitely going to talk about in the future. Another thing that we talked about a couple of episodes ago was the Azeri order for the JF-17 Block 3, which again will probably inject new life into the JF-17 program and, you know, allow the PAF the flexibility to perhaps embark on plans to, you know, induct new Block 3s in place of the older Block 1s that they will be retiring basically soon.
I agree with you, Asim. I think it's also worth looking at or just taking a step back with regards to the JF-17 program and understanding where it came from. I mean, ultimately, the JF-17, it was born out of necessity. The PAF at the time needed a cost-effective multi-role fighter because no one else was really, you know, willing to provide one, especially following the Pressler Amendment, which resulted in the, you know, the U.S. basically withholding the delivery of F-16s to the PAF through the 1990s. In fact, you know, it's interesting. If you look back into the 1980s, there had been an earlier project called Sabre 2, which envisioned turning the F-7 into a multi-role fighter by swapping in a Pratt & Whitney 1120 or GEF-404 turbofan engine, as well as potentially the same radar and avionics as the F-16. Obviously, the costs surrounding that program started to escalate beyond what the PAF was comfortable putting out. But at the same time, and there were also some issues between the US and China that started to emerge. But, you know, the PAF basically walked away from the Sabre 2 and any idea of a homegrown fighter, and instead it opted to buy basically 71 more F-16s. And in fact, even in the early 1990s, Flight International had reported that the PAF was interested in an option for 50 to 60 more F-16s on top of the 71 it already ordered. So basically, you know, from the PAF's own vision in the late 80s, early 90s, it was basically taking on pretty much the same track as many of the F-16 operators at the time, which was to basically double down on the fighter that worked. F-16 production was in full swing, not just in the US, but also, I believe, in, you know, in Turkey, Europe, for example, South Korea. So there's immense, immense economies of scale in that fighter. You know, it for the fighter of its class, it was basically the best platform available, and even to this day, it can be argued that it's been the best platform at its cost, you know, at its cost or price point. The PAF basically walked away from the whole Sabre 2 stuff at that time, and it only returned to the JF-17, which was a different clean sheet fighter project, simply because there was no other option. So I think it would be very naive for us to think that the PAF would favor the JF-17 ahead of, you know, platforms like the J-10 CE, or if it's actually interested in the J-35, especially for its future requirements, which demand more range, greater payload, you know, greater technology capabilities, for example, you know, higher performing active ESA radars and so on and so forth. And it also, I think, you know, even with that in mind, I don't think it spells the end of the JF-17. I still do believe the JF-17 has a great future, even within the PAF, but in more niche roles or niche roles. Like, I think we can get a lot out of the platform if we use it for the sort of roles you wouldn't use a J-10 or J-35 for. So a good example, and this goes into a much bigger discussion which we can have in the future, but one would be, like, for example, close air support for the Army. I mean, I think, you know, with a JF-17, you can arm it with air-to-ground missiles, you can arm it with a submunitions dispenser, you can arm it with anti-radiation missiles, and so on. And that gives you a pretty good scalable asset for things like, you know, a combined arms maneuver. Now, again, that's a much bigger discussion. However, if Pakistan opts to pursue that posture, and I think moving forward, there'll be more discussion and interest towards it, just given how the way things sort of shaked out between India in May, and how to establish conventional deterrence, they need to show the ability to be able to engage on the ground as well. So I think in that context, the JF-17 would have a great future. But again, it ties into a much bigger, deeper discussion, which the armed forces need to have jointly in order to make it happen. That being said, I am pretty much aligned with you. I think for the future, the PEF, you know, their goal is to reach farther, strike harder. And for that, in my view, I think they will prioritize the J10 CE for the, you know, for the remainder of this decade. And then further out, they might look at, for example, the J35. Or I think that they really have their eye out for that ITAR-free con variant, which would give them that 35-ton plus, you know, F-15 sized strike fighter capability, basically. So moving on to our next section, we know that the PEF, you know, speaking of the con, we know that the PEF did look at potentially developing something like that, like a large twin-engine strike-capable fighter, and that was basically Project Azam. However, for all intents and purposes, Project Azam has basically, you know, fallen to the wayside, for lack of a better term, and it'd be really good to visit why that has happened. I mean, you know, even from the PEF's own messaging, Project Azam has been essentially replaced with Project PFX, and Project PFX is taking on a somewhat different approach to fighter development, which we'll go into more detail. But Asim, can you give us a bit of a high level as, you know, what happened with Project Azam and why it's no longer on the table?
Yeah, definitely. So I think we need to put Project Azam into context first. So the context of Project Azam was, hey, we've developed the JF-17, we're producing the JF-17, it's a fourth generation fighter, it's only logical that we start developing a fifth generation fighter and produce that. Now, that was the thinking behind Project Azam. But unfortunately, it's flawed in a couple of important ways. Firstly, this may annoy some people, but the JF-17 wasn't primarily developed by PAC. So the JF-17 is an aircraft developed by Chengdu with very important guidance and inputs from PF officers, right? That's the correct way to view the development of the JF-17, right? It's an aircraft developed entirely in China, with very important guidelines and inputs from PF, you know, engineers and pilots, because they had experience with Western products that the Chinese did not have until that point. And then the Chinese transferred a lot of the production capacity, right, to PAC, and PAC was producing part of the aircraft, and then, you know, acting as sort of like an assembler of things. So, you know, I shouldn't say assembler. I'm looking for a different word.
It would be more of a co-production
integrator.
Yeah, a production partner and an integrator.
So PAC, like, integrated local weapons and, you know, ECM suits from other countries. And, you know, it did small things like that. But the primary aircraft was developed at Chengdu. So the point of pointing that out is that PAC did not really have experience in developing a fighter aircraft or any kind of aircraft for that matter. So that premise was flawed. And obviously, that led to a lot of missteps with Project Azam. Now, Project Azam was hoping to develop a fifth-generation fighter aircraft. So you can imagine how difficult a task that is, not having developed any kind of fighter aircraft ever, right? In the true sense of the word. So I don't want to come off as like a Turkish airspace fanboy, but I think it's very important to look at the TA-TFX, or the CON as it's known now, as a good reference benchmark for what Azam could have or should have been, because it was started at the same time. The ASR, or the requirement, was essentially the same for both aircraft, and we can compare it directly to Azam. So just some very, you know, high-level things. Turkish Aerospace has roughly 6,000 to 7,000 people working on just the TFX. So I'm basing this on some rough estimates, but If someone knows a better number than that, I'm more than happy to be corrected. But roughly speaking, that's the amount of people working on the TFX. Another thing that you want to, and in contrast to Uzm had maybe 300 or 400 people working on it at, you know, the highest number that was ever there. That should tell you the amount of, you know, that should tell you the level of seriousness that, you know, Pakistan had compared to, let's say, Turkish Aerospace. Another thing is Turkish Aerospace actually had previously worked on the F-16, the Hurkuş, and the Hurjet. So they've worked on the production of many aircraft. One of them is actually a jet engine aircraft. And they had contracts with BAE. So they had BAE engineers helping out with the development of the Khan. So that's all the things that they're doing. And they have this entire very large setup that basically, you know, tests and develops the structural components. You know, you have to test each part of an aircraft down to a single coupon. And what that means is you test the entire aircraft, then you test, let's say, each bulkhead, and then you test each part of the bulkhead, and you keep going down and you have to test every single thing. That's the kind of infrastructure that you need to develop a fighter aircraft. Now, this kind of infrastructure is obviously present at Chengdu, but not at PAC, because again, like I said, PAC wasn't the developer of the aircraft, just the producer. So you can contrast all of the things that I've said about, you know, Turkish Aerospace and the Khan project to Uzm. Remember that TFX started basically or a little earlier than Uzm, and until now only they've had two test flights of their prototype, which wasn't even meant to fly initially, but they, you know, but that's a different thing. And they're not hoping to, you know, induct an aircraft in like the fully developed form until maybe 2030 or 2035, right? Like the Block 30 I'm talking about. So, and on top of that, they have like the industrial base, like Aselsan, Roketsan, developing all the inputs that would go into this aircraft. So you can contrast all the things that I've said and then compare it to Pakistan. Do we have any of those things? No. So it was a fool's errand to think that Pakistan could suddenly, you know, start developing a fighter aircraft, and let alone a fifth generation fighter aircraft. Basically, yeah. So it was quite an unrealistic goal. And unfortunately, with you know, a lot of things in Pakistan, was like it felt like Project Uzm was based on a whim of a few people and not on solid planning where people had thought about the capabilities that exist in Pakistan compared to, you know, what was possible. Nobody thought about that. It was like the name Uzm was sort of euphemism for, you know, saying that, you know, we want to do something that was basically impossible. And it was impossible. You can't cheat reality. And another thing, another reason that, you know, Uzm failed was we have to remember that Uzm didn't just include a fifth generation fighter aircraft. They were also developing a male UAV, I believe called Karar. And that program also went nowhere. And roughly speaking, the main reason for that is they were basically building a needlessly redundant system when different strategic organizations in Pakistan, like AWC, you know, NASSCOM and whatnot, they are already producing UAVs. They have decades of experience producing these. And, you know, there's the ones that you would go to develop these. But PSC decided that, you know, we're going to start from scratch and, you know, develop our own UAV that, you know, as we now know with the benefit of hindsight, didn't actually go anywhere. So that's another, you know, reason for that program's failure. Basically, trying to do everything yourself, you know, having not a good estimate of your own capacity. So,
yeah, I think a big tragedy in all this was, and I know people can, they're welcome to look through Kuwa's archives through 2016, 2017. But the big tragedy with Uzm and the PAF's next-gen fighter pursuits at the time was that Turkish Aerospace and the Turkish government, they basically invited the PAF to participate in TFX from the very beginning, right? They had even carved up this opportunity of having, you know, of doing co-production, of sharing in the R&D, of being able to contribute. And it's true, like PAC was not equipped to come in and as like a development partner. But again, you know, it goes back to the bigger discussion of if we had the policy people at the helm, they could have gone to the Turks and said, okay, like PAC may not be the best partner for you, but we can get you connected with people from NESCOM, right, who do have, relatively speaking, much better capacity to help you in TFX. And who knows, right? Like, even if we were to accept that NESCOM was behind, and, you know, from a technology understanding standpoint, that being able to participate in the TFX program directly as early as 2016, 2017, being part of those very early initial conversations, having scientists and engineers who are, you know, in the middle of their NESCOM projects, going into Turkey and actually taking part in active development work and coming back to Pakistan, that could have actually resulted in a much stronger wellspring of R&D knowledge. And we wouldn't have wasted time with Azam. Instead, we would have been part of the Khan project from the very beginning, you know, both in terms of influencing how it, for example, had the PF been there in 2016, 2017 and really asserted its position, right, it could have potentially steered the conversation towards having an ITAR-free engine program much earlier than now, right? We could have had a program which Pakistan could have even participated within, right? Have some co-production or some sort of agreement into as well much earlier. We could have had, you know, the ability to, for example, build in more of the, you know, Khan-related capacity in Pakistan earlier. Turkish Aerospace Pakistan would have been a bigger entity within Pakistan. And plus NESCOM potentially could have spun out its own, you know, dedicated, commercially focused aerospace division or something to make it easier to partner with both the Turks and other countries or other vendors potentially in other areas. So there was this, you know, this, I think the big story here is that this is what happens for good and for bad when you just leave a fighting force to make decisions that are outside of its orbit. You know, as you said, Asim, in the previous episode, when the PAF started JF-17, at the time it was the correct decision because it needed, in its capacity as a fighting force, it needed a fighter that it could leverage for operational needs. And I think that's where that should have ended. Like, once you sign on to the fighter, from there, the project, no, yes, there's a part of it where you have the PAF personnel going in and advising the Chinese on how to develop it and how to incorporate the Western concepts. That's true. But I think the production side should have really been designated or delegated to people, entities, companies, what have you, who understood production, who understood commercial mobilization, who understood these things, which is what we saw in India with the Tejas. Like, for all the Tejas's technical problems and project management issues, they're at a position in India where they can spin up another assembly line. They can have multiple assembly lines. They have integrated smaller companies into the supply chain. Like, these are the sorts of things that should have happened with the JF-17 had it been delegated to the right people once the initial decision was made. So at that point, we could have had the infrastructure similar to Turkey to be enable Pakistan to productively contribute. And I think, you know, even if you factor that out, we still could have made that transition even as late as 2016 had this not been a fighting force decision. And I think this is where the bad part of having a fighting force decide on things comes into the picture, is where they decided, hey, if we could do JF-17, again, not accounting for the fact that they didn't develop it, that they can suddenly do Azam, right? Because again, from a fighting force, you're meant to have confidence in yourself. But there are certain things that this is out of your orbit, that you should have delegated this decision, this planning, this vision to someone or some group like NESCOM, which was better equipped to handle it.
Yeah, and just to add to what you were saying, there's a lot of organization rivalry that is going on that is, you know, not visible to everyone. But if you pay a little bit of attention to what's going on, you can sort of guess. And one thing is that, you know, had Pakistan not been working on Project Azam, they could have wholeheartedly dived into the TFX program at that point. Pakistan did make some effort to, you know, get involved with the TFX, but I certainly believe that at that point, it was our divided attention. And that meant we didn't really go into TFX as like a joint partner. We were just going there in case Project Azam fell apart, which of course it eventually did. But at that point, the Turks were developing their aircraft at such a speed that Pakistan or Pakistani engineers were in no position to contribute or join that program in any meaningful way, right? Because as we know now, the aircraft, or at least the airframe, has flown twice already. So they're at a very advanced stage. So the best Pakistan can, you know, hope for is maybe some kind of production partnership or just a customer, which is, of course, great, but not as great as it could have been. And to the point that I was raising about inter-organization rivalry, Turkish airspace primarily deals with PAC, and that sort of, and PAC tends to jealously guard, you know, involvement in, let's say, TFX from other strategic organizations like, you know, NASSCOM or AWC or any of the other organizations. And it does that because it's like, this is the one thing that, you know, I can control, and it wants everything about the TFX to go through PAC. And as we've discussed earlier, PAC is perhaps not the best organization to equipped to handle, you know, some kind of production capacity for the TFX. Maybe it should have gone to some organization within NASSCOM. So that's another thing, you know, that happens in Pakistan. And unfortunately, there's, you know, I'm not entirely sure what level of, you know, person or which person you would blame for this kind of decision, or if it's a conscious decision at all, right? Like, who made this decision that Turkish airspace would deal primarily with PAC and, you know, not all the strategic organizations as well. So that's like another thing that, you know, causes frictions when, you know, people like, or companies like Turkish airspace are trying to, you know, get a development partner in Pakistan. And believe me, they tried very, very, very hard. Pakistan was their number one priority for a very long time. And it's kind of unfortunate that Pakistan was unable to, you know, utilize that opportunity.
I think a big part of it is institutional inertia. Like, just the way things worked in Pakistan was, number one, there's no shortage of institutions on paper who should have handled this. Like, for example, they had set up NASSCOM primarily to be the prime go-to entity for anything R&D or defense R&D related. That didn't turn out to be the case. And then they set up the Ministry of Defense Production to be the go-to focal entity for everything related to the defense industry. That obviously did not end up being the case. So I think it's the sense that, you know, and the other part of it is that I also, if you look at other countries, especially Turkey, you get the sense that when it comes to defense industry and defense R&D management, the leadership at the helm needs to have a very long shelf life. Like, for example, the current head of Turkey's defense industries, like, let's say, umbrella organization, which is the SSB, he's been around, I think it's Dr. Ismail Demir, he's been around for at least, as far as I can remember, about, you know, close to a decade now. And he has set a tone within the institution, and he's measured by it. Like, he's measured, he has very firm KPIs or key performance indicators he has to answer to. He has to answer to the shareholders involved in, like, Turkish aerospace industry. Even though it's a state-owned organization, it's still answerable to, like, the Turkish Armed Forces Pension Fund and so on. So he has people he has to answer to, and he has to answer in terms of numbers, right? So that's one aspect. So you have a issue of institutional accountability in Turkey, but then you also have institutional consistency. So even though you have people who are sitting in their chairs for a long time, they are constantly measured and assessed by people who care about the numbers. And I think those are two things you lack in Pakistan, where, unfortunately, right, there are not enough people who've been asked, you've been given X budget, what is the ROI? How long did it take to get to the ROI? Why haven't you reached the ROI? What is blocking you? Why is it blocking you? Are you the best person for this job? For example, there are not enough entities or people asking questions as to why, let's say, classic case is Soparco. Why were people from the military being parachuted into Soparco? What do they know about rocket development, satellite development, and so on? So there's a lot of these lack of institutional questions. And just to be clear, it's not a question of military versus civil. It's actually a question of competence versus incompetence. You can be a military-run state, fine. If that's a reality everyone has to accept. But I think the ask on the part of Pakistanis is that at least do it competently. Right. At least because there are examples of countries that do it competently. There are countries that there are dictatorships that do dictatorship competently, like in the Asian Tigers. But it's always a question of, you know, getting the right people for the job and then assessing them based on some objective metric And I think that's what's been missing. And that's sort of the result we see now, where you cannot pin it on any individual or anything, but it's rather the culture needs to get overhauled, where we decide, okay, the defense industry is going to always, is going to exist before any leader, and it needs to exist after any government or leader. So therefore, it needs longevity. Its leadership needs stability, and it needs the right people at the helm. It needs scientists running scientific organizations. It needs production experts leading the production organizations. It needs real business experts leading the business organizations. And we need to get the best ones across each. And to be frank, and you know, this is not to offend anyone, but the best ones for these things are probably not going to be within the armed forces in its current state. Because the armed forces, their job is to fight, right? So the operational procedures, culture, knowledge, everything is geared towards, you know, efficiency in a short-term sense. But when it comes to the long-term structural aspect of running an industry, then you need to bring industry people in, right? The chair people of, or the, you know, the board of directors and your directors and, you know, director generals or whatever of organizations like PAC should ideally be Pakistanis who've worked at Boeing. Or maybe you might dispute that even given Boeing's situation. But let's say Pakistanis have worked at other aerospace companies overseas, which is what you see in Turkey. Similarly, for other R&D entities, it would be Pakistanis who've worked for other foreign R&D entities who can bring in that fresh expertise and knowledge. For business development, it would be people who worked at Deloitte, KPMG, right? Big corporations overseas or even within Pakistan itself. Like, you have people everywhere who can do the thing that you want the, that you want these institutions to do. And they've been measured by the toughest KPIs, by the toughest boards, in the toughest high-stress environments. And they're not contributing towards your country. They're contributing towards the Gulf, America, Canada, US. And I think that's the tragedy as well. So any thoughts on that, Asim?
Yeah, no. I think that's, yeah, we've dumped on PAC a lot.
Okay, so moving on to the future. You know, now we're in terms of, I think today the main project that PAC has is basically PFX. And it's both promising, but for the same reasons as Azam, it's also both concerning. Asim, can you just give us a sense of what is happening with Project PFX?
Yeah. So the goals of PFX are sort of nebulous. The only detailed or the most detailed view of what that project is a slide from a presentation that was given by NASTEP, I believe, which has four phases of Project PFX, the first of which is basically a localization effort on the JF-17, and the final phase of that is some sort of advance to 4.5 generation fighter aircraft. Now, on the whole, I certainly believe PFX is a more realistic goal than Project Azam ever was. But on the other hand, you know, the final phase of this project, if it's like a development of a 4.5 generation fighter aircraft, I don't know how realistic that is. Or the more important question is, even if it is really realistic, does PAF actually want an aircraft like that? Or does PAF want to buy more G-10s and more JF-17 Block 3s, right? So is that need connected with the PAF, you know, fighting force side? Or is that just like an effort of the engineering side deciding one day that that's something nice and fancy to develop, right? So that makes me sort of suspicious or, you know, skeptical of the success of that end of the PFX program. On the other hand, if the goal, or I mean, it is the first goal after all, is the localization effort of the JF-17. I think that's very important and the logical next step, or one of the logical next steps for the JF-17, as I think I said earlier as well. So as we know, PAC only produces part of the structure of the JF-17. The rest is produced in China and, you know, flown into PAC. So I think goal number one of PFX first phase is going to absorb that capacity. Now, the question is, do we have the capacity to absorb that production capacity? So what that means is, can the machines that are needed for that production be imported into Pakistan? Are there any import restrictions? What about the material, right? So all the aluminum for the JF-17 comes from China right now, or I don't know. I suspect it comes from China. It's not produced locally. Is that still going to come from abroad? Or are we going to set up some kind of production for that metal, which might be useful for any other aircraft programs that we will start in the future, right? That's a That's an open question. Another open question is the avionics stack, right? So we know that Pakistan has been working in some shape or form on a local AESA fighter, you know, fire control radar. Now, will that make its way onto the PFX? Now, a challenge with that sort of thing is when you install a new radar, you need to basically design a new radome as well. So I don't mean that the shape of the radome necessarily changes. It's just that the radar needs to operate through the radome. So the radome is essentially transparent to radio waves or the specific frequencies of radio waves that the radar is emitting and receiving. Now, because an AESA radar is much more flexible and operates on much larger frequencies, you know, angles and stuff, it's more, you know, intense compared to a regular pulse Doppler radar. The design of the radome for an AESA radar is a challenge in itself. And I don't know if we have the capacity to do that. So just saying, just putting it out there that installation of a new radar is just not as simple as just bolting on a radar. You need to, you know, redesign many different parts of the aircraft as well. And maybe a realistic, you know, avenue for the first phase of PFX is just to focus on the structural capacity. So just manufacture 100% of the structure in Pakistan while maintaining the Chinese avionics and weapons package. Because at this point, the Chinese avionics and weapons stack is very well integrated and well developed. So it's a machine that's well oiled and works well together. So maybe it's not worth messing with that, you know, balance. And this will limit the scope of the PFX and hopefully, you know, leave some funds that are probably needed for the procurement of things like J-10 or something. So we should definitely only bite off only what we can chew. So we should not be over ambitious and do another awesome.
I agree. And I think, you know, when it comes to number one, I think localizing the JS-17 production is a good idea. It's just that a lot of it does depend on China. If they are willing to release the sensitive tooling and equipment necessary to manufacture it. That being said, I would say the PAC will eventually have the capacity in the sense that as the Mirages and F7s finally retire out, that there is at least physical capacity to be able to, you know, extend the JS-17 production line. Question then is like, is there enough order potential to make use of that extended overhead? Because at the end of the day, you know, if you're bringing in, let's say, $300-400 million worth of production equipment, that needs to get distributed out enough across enough units to make it worthwhile. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a very expensive locally built fighter because you have to then, you know, get a return on those costs. So I think this is where both long-term PAF orders aimed at keeping that 150 to 200 number of JS-17 in service is going to matter. But also the pursuit of big export orders like the one from Azerbaijan will also matter because these are the ones that will really drive that economies of scale to be able to justify the extended overhead. But I think it's a good idea, and if only from an R&D and learning perspective, to be able to produce a whole fighter domestically, because then you see the whole end-to-end stack of what's involved in getting it together. It's also a good fallback for having a domestic fighter that you can produce locally, in the sense from a strategic standpoint. Having that home domestic built fighter can also help you control costs in the long run, because you control the labor, you could potentially eventually begin controlling the input as well, like the aluminum, if you choose to continue expanding your investment in localizing more of the fighter as opposed to, you know, just importing inputs from elsewhere. So it's a good ecosystem to build. It's just a question of, at the end of the day, like with the PAF at the helm of this, is that do they have enough money to make the trade-offs happen? Because at the end of the day, they just came off with a fight from India, and that's going to now affect a lot of procurement decisions, I feel, towards near-term off-the-shelf purchases, which means that platforms like the J-10CE will likely see priority. And if they cannot afford the J-10CE in enough numbers, then the next option will be to procure more JS-17 Block 3s as they are, because it's already available, the design's been finalized, it's frozen, it works. Let's get more of those units across as well. But that being said, exporting the JS-17 is going to matter a lot. And yes, at some level, it's going to be a challenge because countries might look at Pakistan and say, well, you know, you're more leaning towards the J-10. Why would we invest in the JS-17? But it's not for those countries that have an established air force. I think the JS-17's actual market potential is going to be in countries like Azerbaijan, which are looking to make a switch, a bigger switch from a doctrinal standpoint away from, you know, the Soviet-Russian approach to the more, let's say, flexible hybrid Western approach, which the PAF has pretty much developed through its experience. So there's an opportunity where you can get the fighter, but the PAF isn't going to, you know, Pakistan isn't just going to dump a fighter on you and leave. No, it'll bring the fighter, but then it'll also give you access to the entire process of training from the very beginning all the way up to being able to, you know, build a doctrine around the fighter. So it gives you this opportunity to really just basically rebuild your air force or transition your air force towards a new generation. And I think that's really the sell point of the JSF. And if the messaging around it is communicated clearly enough, or the positioning around it is built well enough, they can generate those kinds of orders, especially in countries like, you know, besides Azerbaijan, but also potentially in, let's say, Iraq, right? But I think that aside, local production is a good starting point and bringing it local is a good pursuit. It's just whether, as you said, is it realistic just given the other priorities on the table. So I think the chances of it being more realistic is going to depend on export orders in the long run, as opposed to just purely PAF's domestic priorities. Because again, they want platforms that can reach farther and strike harder. And the JS-17 design just isn't meant for that right now.
Just to, you know, build on what you said, I know Pakistan has a problem with creating new organizations, but I'm about to suggest one anyway. So what, you know, something that would be, you know, perfect for Pakistan, in my opinion, would be, I shouldn't say a new organization. I should just say that PAC should be detached from the Air Force. Don't change anything on the ground. Just change how it's operating and how it's managed, right? So just compare it to how the Turkish Aerospace Industries operates, right? It's essentially the same thing, but it's made to operate to make profits, right? So you detach it from the Air Force. You don't say you're guaranteed, you know, infinite amount of funds. You say, you can get this amount of funds and the rest you have to generate from, you know, exports and, you know, sales to PAF. And they operate like a business. And this is something that we've talked about in earlier podcasts as well, that with the eventual, you know, retirement of F-7s and Mirages, all that, you know, real estate at PAC is going to be, you know, vacant. So that could be geared towards export orders, or, you know, maybe this new independent PAC that's maybe, you know, not, you know, controlled entirely by the PAF is able to, you know, join, for example, some part of the production of the Khan program, for example, right? It uses some of its idle production capacity for that. So maybe one of the hot takes that I can give is create or separate PAC from the PAF and make it into its own company that works for profit. You don't have to move officers away from PAF or PAC and, you know, make it all civilian or anything like that. Because we understand that, you know, that's kind of radical. And the problem, as you said, isn't civilian versus forces, it's competence versus incompetence. And in this case, it's actually a case of, well, the incentives being all wrong. There's no incentive for PAC to make a profit because they are guaranteed funds from the government because they're part of the PAF. But once they're separated into a company that is asked to make a profit and, you know, asked why they're not making profits, then they have more of an incentive to do the things that we want.
So just to like actually build into that a bit, I think it's an interesting thought exercise because let's say the PAF splits off PAC. PAC now becomes a state-owned enterprise, standalone, similar to NESCOM. So here's what the impact will be. So right now it does have a sense of, let's say, a subsidy net by virtue of being part of the PAF. So the PAF dedicates or allocates a portion of its operational expense towards maintaining PAC. And that also includes, unfortunately, maintaining relatively underused production, or let's say support capacity, which is with the F-7 and the Mirage rebuild factories, which are going to start to wind down. If you spin off PAC, what's going to happen is the PAF's contracts for those line items will definitely decrease, meaning that PAC itself cannot afford to hold on to those facilities. So it immediately, as you said, it realigns the incentive structure because now they're going to look at it. Let's say the executive general manager, he's going to look at it or she's going to look at it and say, okay, well, like, I don't think we can maintain this surplus capacity, right? We're not getting any orders from the PAF for the F7 or the Mirage. Therefore, this is not a good use of money from our end. It'll put us into debt if we maintain it, because that's the issue of having a subsidy net, is that this unused, unproductive capacity, is this a money hole, basically? It's a money pit. So we don't want to take on the debt because we don't have that subsidy net anymore. So you have two options now. You either go and push for investment to then upgrade those facilities to take on something else. So you go out to the industry, you might even take out like a line of credit. So let's say you're anticipating, based on your communications with the PAF, your chairman says, hey, like I know the PAF wants to get into, and this will be our next topic, UCAF technology. So let's go and invest in building the production capacity, or at least some sort of capacity for UCAF development, for example. So you get a loan, have to justify it in front of commercial people. They're going to get involved because they want to get their money back potentially. So suddenly you get this infusion of, you know, as we said, from a competency and incentive standpoint, the right people coming in and helping you, you know, bridge the gaps between what you don't know about the business side and the commercial side. And they come in and help build the gaps. Or the other alternative is that you're PAC and you're now sitting on this excess capacity. You can go back to the PAF and say, look, when you're about to sign your next contract order, or when you're about to release that RFP, you should demand offsets. You should demand like a 50 to 100% commercial offset. And we can make this excess capacity available to that foreign partner. It opens it up to all the OEMs. Let's say, you know, Leonardo, for example, wins it. Well, now you're going to force Leonardo to go in and say, okay, you have to reinvest in Pakistan. And one thing Leonardo can come back and say is, okay, sure, we'll reinvest in this PAC capacity and turn it into an MRO facility. And now Leonardo's incentive structure is that they want to make the most out of their investment, because they're just putting in, let's say, $500 million back into Pakistan in some capacity. The ideal scenario would be that this $500 million somehow generates $1 billion, $2 billion. And suddenly PAC becomes this regional MRO center for all the Leonardo aircraft in South Asia, Central Asia, or like Middle East and so on. You know, we have, you know, even though it's true, for example, the Gulf Arab states are advancing in their industries, Pakistan can still produce the labor and skill of engineers and scientists and technicians, right, to scale out and provide actual capacity. So suddenly PAC becomes this focal point for like regional services. And by the way, this is not something new. I remember back in Ideas 2018, I spoke to Turkish Aerospace, and they basically said that this was the kind of the vision they're trying to sell PAC at the time with the Turkish Aerospace Industries helicopter programs, like the T-625, for example, and T-129 as well at the time. The idea was that PAC could eventually become this regional MRO site, essentially, or MRO facility for all of Turkish Aerospace's customers in like Central Asia and so on. So this is the kind of thing that we're talking about when we say spin it off. And this is the kind of result you will get when you open up the doors to more people who know what they're doing and who have experience in this area. And this is a constant story we keep coming back to. And it's a big contrast to the Pasan nuclear program. In the nuclear program, we had 15 to 20 years of R&D happening at the helm of scientists. So the point being is that, you know, that entire nuclear program was built on very firm foundations, led by people who knew what they were doing in that sphere. What you have now with aerospace is that, again, you have a fighting force whose job is, you know, is their job is to think short term. That's their incentive structure. They have to, because a war can happen anytime. But these are not always the right people to have leading an industry, right? To have leading entities that, again, are accountable to some form of ongoing KPIs and ROI and these sorts of things. And that's where you need to open it up to people and groups who can manage it. And those people and groups exist. They definitely exist. But again, if the environment is not conducive towards competency, meritocracy, then you're not going to attract those people. Which then leads to our next conversation, which is to now go into more of what Pakistan should do for the future. I think, Asim, you and I have broadly agreed that, look, if the goal is to one day develop an original fighter program, that the best starting point for whether it's NESCOM, whether it's PAC, whoever, the best starting point for Pakistan's aerospace industry to make this right would be in terms of unmanned combat aerial vehicles, or UCAVs. So do you want to give a kick off there?
Yeah, of course. So let me just preface this by saying, you know, developing a manned aircraft and, you know, operating it is a complicated and expensive endeavor. And sometimes we don't appreciate that as much as we should, right? So first of all, pilot is a very expensive resource, right? It takes decades to train that human. And then every time that person, you know, flies, if they die, it's a huge loss for the fighting force. So the training of the pilot itself is like a very complicated thing. Now, another thing is you need to design the aircraft around the pilot. So what this means is almost every system is developed with the pilot in mind. This introduces very stringent requirements for quality of the engineering and safety. I mean, firstly, there's a certain size that you can, you know, as small, like fighter jets can be only as small as a certain point. After that, they become too small to support even a single human pilot. So there's a certain size limit that you will always have with manned aircraft. You can't get any smaller than that. And obviously size is strongly related to cost. So it will be an expensive aircraft to design, procure, and operate. And like I said, having a person, you know, inside the aircraft means you need to certify and you be absolutely sure that your aircraft is safe to operate. So for example, when it comes to the structural design, I think I hinted at this earlier as well, that, you know, you need to start testing from the entire aircraft, then down to different components like bulkheads, spars, and whatnot. And then individual, you know, coupons of material that made up that part, right? So you need to test everything so that whatever computer models that you have of this aircraft not failing agree with what you're actually building. And the production needs to be designed so that, you know, all those requirements are met. So producing a manned aircraft has very, very strict requirements. And anyone who has worked in, you know, let's say the commercial airliner industry would know that very intimately. All of this engineering quality, you know, requirements and safety requirements have a huge financial overhead. So what I'm trying to say is developing a manned aircraft is A, expensive, and B, very complicated. Furthermore, there are some things, you know, or some slight gaps that exist with the use of manned fighters in this day and age. And we can, you know, sort of discuss this a little bit more. But in the context of the recent conflict with India in May, we saw that Air Force bases were attacked. And, you know, what if they were attacked in such a way that, you know, some of the runways or hangars were disabled and you lost some aircraft on the ground? That would be a very huge loss. And the gap here is that manned fighters are essentially tied to Air Force bases, right? They have very limited or no ability to operate, you know, from anywhere except a well-established supply chain, you know, managed Air Force base. And let's say a UCAV or a UAV could possibly, you know, have that, you know, restriction on its operation. Furthermore, operating a manned fighter is very expensive. And that's because A, it is big, so it uses up a lot of fuel. Then B, you have a lot of maintenance that you need to do. You need to maintain the engine. You need to maintain the hydraulics, the avionics, and everything. There's a cost to that. And then, of course, you need to pay the pilot, right? So correct me if I'm wrong, but I've read numbers as high as $20,000 per hour for, you know, the F-16ers, or $27,000 per hour. So these are very high numbers. So a UAV could potentially be smaller and be operated for much cheaper as well, right? So there are some advantages to UAVs. And the most important thing, or one of the most important things, is it is likely the next logical step for Pakistan's aerospace industry. Because like I said earlier, Pakistan doesn't really have experience developing, but it does have a lot of experience developing UAVs and cruise missiles. So it has a lot of the inputs and the industrial base and the human resource knowledge needed for developing, you know, UCAVs that are possibly slightly bigger than what we have right now. But it's the, you know, incremental small steps that you need to take to develop industry. So you don't take huge leaps. Those are only, you know, fanciful ideas that don't actually work. You need to take small steps, and UCAV development, to me at least, or, you know, to all of us seems like the logical next step for Pakistan's aerospace industry.
I agree. And, you know, we will go into more of the technical details of how to do it or how Pakistan could do it in our next episode. But for this one, I think it's really worth sort of looking at what we're talking about here and understanding why we're saying the UCAS are the next step. So if you take, for example, PAC or NESCOM or even NESCOM today, right, and you ask them, go make me a fifth gen fighter like Project Azam, they're going to look at what they have right now and then look at your goal, and they cannot see the link. They will not see the link because they don't have any of the core R&D and production foundations to make it happen. Like as Asim said, to make a crewed fighter platform, you need a lot of inputs in relation to, you know, the pilot's safety and well-being, right down to just the size of the platform itself. And, you know, with Azam, it wasn't just that they said, we need a manned fighter. No, they went all the way. We need the biggest manned fighter that can carry like directed energy weapons kind of goal, right? Which means that it is insane to expect our current R&D, our current production, our current know-how to be able to connect to that, because there's no connection to build on. You have to literally fabricate or create new foundations from scratch across hundreds of areas. And just to give you a number, as Asim said earlier, you have 6,000 to 7,000 people from Turkish Aerospace working on the Khan alone. That doesn't even include the people who worked on the Hurjet trainer, the trainer program, which is the smaller manned application. It doesn't even include the people who are still working on the F-16 upgrade. It doesn't include the people who are working on the more forward-facing R&D that's being fed back into the Khan and these other programs. Turkish Aerospace has a huge labor pool of engineers and scientists that you could, I don't want to exaggerate, but you could potentially fit all of what Pakistan in terms of R&D has, and you still have unused capacity at Turkish Aerospace. That's the issue. But if you take a step back and then look at, let's say, UCAV technology, now you tell the same entities, especially NESCOM, which does have experience, lots of experience developing drones and cruise missiles and target drones. You go to them and say, we need a 2-ton, 3-ton loyal wingman UCAV similar to what the Americans are making. Now, it's still a lot of work. Don't get me wrong. It's still a lot of work, but they can see that link. They can see that connection of how to get there, because they will see that, okay, this at its most fundamental level, yes, there are a lot of nuances, but at its most fundamental level, it's a large cruise missile, right? This thing that they're asking us to make is a recoverable cruise missile, right? So yes, we will need a turbofan engine, but it could be like 10, 15 kilonewtons. It doesn't have to be like a GE F404 or RD93 class. It could be a much smaller, more accessible turbofan engine, which we can get from China or whatever, right? The airframe needs to have an internal payload. Yes, that does create a complication where it needs to be able to like carry a store and then launch the store. Fair enough, it requires hard points, that is complicated. But again, it's not something we haven't done before. We do have some experience doing that for past PAF programs. Fair enough. You know, it requires an avionics stack. Okay, this is very complicated, but again, we have a lot of work already that has gone into the JF-17 or other programs. We can expand upon it. So it's a conversation of expanding and developing what you already have. Again, just to preface, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. It would take a few years to even get to the point where you have like a, you know, a tech demonstrator that's taxiing on the runway. Forget about flying. That's all true, but it is doable. The tragedy goes back to me, you know, we kind of scratch our heads, is that if we had only begun this kind of project back when Project Azam was being conceived. Like, let's say we went to the Turks and said, hey, we want to join the TFX, and the Turks come back and tell us, hey, you know, this is a next-gen fighter program. It needs collaborative systems. How about you take the lead on the UCAV technology? We could have started that 5-6 years ago, and we could have had the tech demonstrator today had we maintained that focus. And I think that's like the tragedy of it. Because it is doable. It was doable, and it's now more doable today. Just true, because you can look at some of NESCOM's projects which are coming out, like the Rasub air-launched cruise missile, the Azab 81LR. These are original NESCOM design projects. These are very good air-to-surface munition designs. So clearly there is an R&D base that they have leveraged to develop this stuff. So the point being is that, yes, the foundations are there, and we could have leveraged this earlier. But instead, we got into this whole like drama of like redundant institutions doing redundant projects, and then those redundant projects evidently failing and just going and having this inter-organizational rivalry that delayed us from getting to this point. And the other point is, I just want to add, is that, you know, why UCAPS? And we'll get to this, we'll go into this more detail next episode. But unlike a manned fighter, we can generate the scale for it. What I mean is the demand for this kind of platform, both within Pakistan and outside, with countries looking to accumulate UCAP technology of their own, would extend into the thousands, right? So the production potential for this kind of platform would go in excess of 1,000, possibly even 2,000, because the thing is, like, countries like the Gulf, in the Gulf states or the Middle East, they're going to be looking and saying, hey, we need to get as many UCAP suppliers on our side as possible. If Pakistan's manufacturing a whole bunch of UCAPs, let's get them into our supply chain as well. So that's where it's very important to invest in this kind of project, because the return on investment is a much more realistic goal than, let's say, a crude fighter, which, you know, you might induct 150, 200. In all likelihood, you'll have a lot of prior R&D expense that hasn't really been, you know, hasn't been, let's say, amortized through enough production, unless you get lucky and have a lot of export orders, which is, as you know, with crude fighters, is very hard. With UCAVs, you can amortize that overhead sooner, and then you can start moving on to more advanced applications and maybe more advanced UCAV designs later on. So it's just the right area for Pakistan and Pakistan's aero industry to get into. And instead of trying to replicate what everyone else is doing, we can start to interoperate, right? We can interoperate with the Turks, we interoperate with the Chinese industry. So we get what we need from them. And then in return, we can say, hey, we can offer this kind of stuff as well, you know, so try to get like some offsets and that kind of thing. So that's where, you know, that's where the potential is. Like, what do you think about that, Asim?
Yeah, so it's funny that, you know, Pakistan is basically in a security environment, which is, you know, very military intensive. So we spend a lot of money on defense and we have to. And that creates like this, you know, family of defense enthusiasts, because there's so much potential. And that's what excites us into doing what we do. And, you know, we don't just see what's happening right now and get disappointed by that, but we look to the possibility of what it could be, right? And that's what we're trying to do here as well. And as you said, that we're going to discuss UCAPs on our next episode. But, you know, another thing that excites me is, you know, the possibility of Pakistan eventually becoming the world, you know, loyal wingman expert, right? So that's our USP. That's a country that you go to if you want, you know, a loyal wingman for your next generation fighter aircraft, right? So that's the vision that, you know, I sometimes, or someone may argue naively have. But, you know, that's the dream that I have.
I agree. And just to stress how close we are to be able to pursue this kind of project, like the ground, like the basic studies and development work can start today. It can literally start today, because what they need to do is this, and we'll go into this in more detail in the next episode, but they just need to start leveraging the target drones that they already have and already have been producing. In fact, that's what Turkish Aerospace did, basically. Like, they had their, and just, you know, I apologize for the mispronunciation, but they had the Simshek target drone, and then they basically developed that up into the Super Simshek. So basically that became like their decoy drone. So it was slightly larger, maybe about 20-30% bigger than the original target drone. It was enlarged to basically provide more range, more payload. And then they started using, like, you know, electronic warfare equipment as a payload. Just basically see if the drone could work as a jamming asset. So instead of having to load your fighter planes with dedicated jamming pods, you send these drones out, which can then extend further, reach further, distribute the jamming emissions across the battlefield a bit better, right? And at the other end, that also helped them collect data of what would be required to start, you know, building autonomous air agents, basically, or air operations vehicles, right? So that those drones, those decoy drones, would collect the data and it helped them understand what it would take to then start developing the loyal wingman platforms, like the Anka 3, for example. So the point being is that we have the root foundations to even start the studies, like, right now. The problem is that, again, it's like, you know, there was no policy voice that came out and said, hey, drones are the future And we're not saying this in terms of like they're going to replace manned fighters, but we're saying in terms of our conflicts, our threat scenario, that if our air bases come under attack, we need to deploy air power somehow. And drones give us the capacity to do it at scale. So we need these kind of platforms to enter production and fill our numbers. And then we can also use them as very offensive assets as well. So, you know, instead of potentially having a limited air response, you could have used UCAVs in serious numbers to mount a very aggressive air response into Indian territory and not care about the losses because they're drones. That's their job. So it changes the equation from a strategic standpoint. If others see that we have that industry, that we're able to roll these out by the dozens, by the hundreds each year, that is what helps you get conventional deterrence. It's not just your ability to deploy them. You show the world that you have the ability to produce them. And in some ways, it's like that's the best practice that the nuclear side of our equation has sort of established and that we've been riding off of as a country, is that, you know, the nuclear side of it is that we showed the world that, hey, we can rapidly get a uranium-based warhead into production and test it very rapidly. Like, I think it was like, you know, but from the time Dr. Ikyu Han proposed it to the time that we had a ready-to-use, you know, warhead, it was like 8 years, very rapid. To then transition towards the plutonium side to say that, hey, we can now scale this out and produce more advanced warheads, and we have the capacity to do this indigenously through the Khoshab reactor. That's what gives you your nuclear deterrence, both the ability to deploy, but also the ability to produce. And I think we want to bring that same mentality over to the aerospace and wider conventional field as well. So with that, I think we can conclude this episode. Next episode, we will be discussing how Pakistan can basically design and develop its own UCAV, and from there potentially transition into developing its own next generation fighter. So again, I thank Asim for joining me for this episode. And thank you all for, again, listening to another episode of Defense Uncut. Take care. And again, feel free to reach out to us with any questions using the podcast at kuwa.org link. And we will get back to you as soon as we can. Take care. Bye.